This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Yesterday we were talking about calm abiding and insight as expressed in Dogen's Sovereign of Samadhi's Samadhi essay. Calm abiding focuses on non-conceptual images or objects like the breath, the body, sounds, images. Or mind itself is a non-conceptual object. And those are the objects of observation for shamatha, calm abiding, and for vipassana, or inquiry practice, leading to insight into the nature of things. Vipassana practice focuses on conceptual objects. Like that come in the form of questions, sentences with letters and question marks at the end. Anything that comes packaged in words is, I think we pretty much have to say, conceptual. So there's a kind of meditation practice offered by Shakyamuni Buddha and Dogen Zenji in this essay that allows focusing on conceptual objects. It uses some conceptuality in the form of these inquiry questions. And how is that different from all the conceptuality we're engaged in all day, all the questions we're asking ourselves all day? It's a little different in Zazen. Ideally, it's happening within the realm of calm abiding that is already been developed through focusing on non-conceptual images. So there's already a settled presence in which these questions may start arising, somewhat conceptual questions. And that's what makes it a little different than just ordinary, everyday, run-of-the-mill questioning. It's happening in the space of presence, settledness, and it's gentle questioning, not heavy-handed, like, here's the question, and just like this, and okay, where's the answer? More like gently asking the question, so the conceptuality of the question doesn't disturb the presence of shamatha too much. I think we have to actually give up a little bit of the complete calmness of shamatha in order to formulate any question. It's a sacrifice we're willing to make, maybe. So it's gentle questioning. And a key point is that it's not a theoretical questioning. It's an experiential questioning about this very presence that we are abiding in. It's not about some other time and place. It's not about somebody else. It's not theoretical. It's about our own personal direct experience, which hopefully is already quite fresh and vivid and available because we're in this calm, spacious realm, total realm of sitting called shamatha, calm abiding. And these questions are not, that's sort of a style of question. It's gentle, it's experiential, it's not theoretical. It's about here and now in this very experience. This is the type of question, or the style of question. But what about like, what questions to actually ask? Some questions aren't that essential. Someone yesterday, Doka-san brought up something like the feeling that they were learning how to ask the right questions in Zazen. And I think this is definitely part of Vipassana, learning what questions are most important to ask. This reminds me of a story about Jikoji's founder, Kobun Chinoroshi. He would often come down to Tassajara in the summers to visit and give some talks to the Tassajara residents and guests. And my wife, Shoho, first started practicing Zen with Kobun in Austria and Switzerland. So she knew him and she was at Tassajara. So one summer when Kobun was down there, Shoho was his attendant, Jisha. And so she, you know, carried incense for him into the, I think that he would often give these talks in the dining room instead of the Zendo. He liked to be more informal so that they could have more open question and answer kind of dialogue. He was intimidated by Zendo. So he had just a question and answer discussion in the dining room one time. And people asked all kinds of questions. And I don't know exactly what kinds of questions they asked, but maybe things like, because Kobun is kind of a special person in the history of Tassajara. He was there at the very beginning. So they maybe asked him things like, well, how was it back in the 60s practicing in Tassajara? What was that like? And you started practicing in Japan. How does Japanese Zen and American Zen compare? And maybe other questions like this would be very interesting to hear Kobun's response. But so they had this discussion this question and answer period, and then left the dining room, Kogan and Shoho. And after they got outside and back together, Kogan said to his attendant, Shoho, "Wrong questions." Nice oral transmission story of one side of Kobe. I think very to talking to everybody and applying to all that, but maybe a little disappointed that these weren't like really about the essential matter, these questions. For all of us, we can ask ourselves, what is the essential matter, the great matter? What is most important in the short time we have left in this life? We've come so far to be here practicing Zen in a sesshin. This is an inconceivable gift to have discovered Buddha Dharma in this lifetime. If we imagine all the lifetimes and all the realms, all the time we have been earthworms and people so caught up in so many things that we've happened to come upon the Buddha Dharma. So in this lifetime, it's already like a miracle, a tiny chance to have discovered this practice and these teachings. These teachings, this tradition that potentially offer complete freedom and liberation from discontent, that offer the possibility of boundless compassion for all beings. So it's already wonderful that we've come this far, like unspeakably wonderful. And what if we don't get another chance after this lifetime for a long, long time? So in the time remaining, one question we could ask ourselves is, what are the essential questions? What is really most important here to clarify? There could be many such questions, and it might be a different list for each of us. Questions we can ask the Buddhas, questions we can ask teachers, questions we can ask ourselves, which is particularly the practice of Vipassana, is we're inquiring into our own mind. We're asking our own experience, deeply asking. There's nobody in there that will tell us, although we can style these questions and explore these questions based on lots of hints from the Buddhas and ancestors' teachings. These teachings can like give us hints of the kind of questions to ask ourselves. And many ways to frame the great matter. And there's many different Buddhist schools and traditions that would frame it somewhat differently. But I think one thing they all have in common is that if we're identified with this body and mind collection of five aggregates, technical talk, if we're identified with this this impermanent experiences of body and mind as ourself, we perfect containment and freedom is impossible, according to the Buddha's. This is from the get-go, really the Buddha's very first setting in motion the wheel of Dharma up through all the great vehicle teachings, middle way, and the mind-only traditions, and the Chinese traditions of Tian Tai and Huayan, Pure Land and Zen, up through all the schools of Japanese Zen, Theravada, Vajrayana. I think this point is universal. If we're identified with these changing experiences of body and mind as ourself, then ourself is subject to suffering and birth, old age, sickness, and death, discontent, and so on. So it's we could look at this practice as a kind of a matter of shifting our perspective on what is our true identity. Shifting our identity doesn't mean that there's not a body and mind happening, but is that who we really are? Is that our true identity? And these are some questions. This territory is kind of some possibilities to explore in Vipassana. That's body and mind, identification with body and mind seems to be a big issue from the get-go of Buddhist teachings. And it's interesting that then Dogen frames his own awakening in terms of this issue of body and mind. Body and mind dropped off. Zen saying that may not be so clear exactly what this means or how Dogen understood these words and had great awakening upon hearing these conceptual words. What did that mean for him? Of course, after he heard these words and body and mind dropped off, still, this body that we call Dogen then walked over to his teacher's room to talk with him and spoke some words and had some thoughts in order to speak some words. So conventionally speaking, there was body and a mind happening. So what does it mean it dropped off? In the total realm of sitting, phrase Dogen uses in this sovereign of samadhis, the total universe, the complete realm of sitting, which we could take in all encompassing boundless presence. In such a realm as this, what is body and mind? Where are body and mind? What's the relationship of body and mind and boundless presence? These are some questions we could ask. And he kind of asks, the questions he recommends asking do mention body and mind. And they're a little bit challenging the way he puts the questions. Like, is it sitting within body and mind, or is it sitting or drop off sitting within body and mind? Body in the realm of spacious awareness, boundless presence, in which we are always sitting, but we can verify more and more directly in Zazen. From the point of view of boundless presence, body seems to be a series of experiences, particularly tactile experiences, right? Physical sensation, constantly changing, pleasant and unpleasant, maybe sometimes neutral. Seems like in all different places, different sensations, flow of sensations, and then we can look at the body, and then it's visual images. Yeah, now especially we can look at it on a screen, and that's very different than a physical sensation. That's like a visual image. It seems to be the body, and we kind of combine. There's an itch in this ear, and I can look at it on the screen. Like, yeah, it appears and it has a sensation and it has a sight at the same time. They seem to be located in the same place, so it's pretty convincing. If maybe there's an actual body there, but from the point of view of our bound presence, really just sensations and sights, right, coming together. Isn't that our actual direct experience of the body? And are these experiences of sensation and sight coming from outside this boundless presence? Or are they emerging within the boundless presence? Are they just boundless presence taking the form of sensations and sights and sounds temporarily? Are they coming from outside it or within it? And so if we're really calling it boundless presence, then the answer is not so secretly hidden within the name boundless presence, right? Because boundless means there are no boundaries or edges. That's what boundless means. It's all inclusive. So if there are no boundaries, then these sensations and sights cannot be coming from outside of this boundless presence. That's why it might be very helpful to investigate really if there are any boundaries or edges to this presence or awareness, which is part of Dogen's questioning here. At the very time of your sitting, thoroughly investigate whether the total realm of sitting is vertical or horizontal. Commentators say horizontal means see if it has any spatial dimensions, and vertical means see if it has any temporal dimensions. Does it come and go? It's a kind of vertical element, and does it have a size or location is the kind of spatial element of horizontality, according to Menzan Zenji's comments. And we talked a little bit about how it's maybe easier to verify the timelessness of boundless presence than to verify the locationlessness of presence. And I also think within the locationlessness, I think it's easier to verify the edgeless boundlessness than to verify the centerlessness of presence. In other words, we can see that I really can't find any edges here. It really seems like space. Maybe easier to discern that, yes, it's like space, but I feel like there's a center in the middle of space, kind of from which all of space is like emerging or emanating or centered around. It seems to be like in the body, something like this. See how it seemed to me, and you could explore this as we're talking, right? Doesn't it seem easier to verify, at least get closer to verifying the edgelessness, boundlessness of presence? That's the outer boundaries we're talking about. It seems a little bit easier to explore that and verify that we can't find any edges, rather than to verify that there's no center here. It feels like there's a centeredness in the body or the head. Because of the way our sensory equipment is set up. But if we can first verify and really get used to the sense of boundlessness and edgelessness, the more we get used to that, and it's therefore that this presence is very much like space, like outer space, then we can even consider, this is a little bit conceptual, but we can even consider outer space and consider this outer space, if it has no edges, it's truly boundless. Could it have a center? How could anything that's boundless have a center? It can feel like a center, and we can, you know, put a particle in the middle of outer space and say, like, this particle is the center of space. But it's just from the particle's point of view, of course, it would feel like it was the center. So in a way, center is like a point of view. But we could imagine lots of different particles in space, and each of them would feel like the center. But from the point of view of space, it has no center. Space doesn't think that particle is in my center. But the particle feels as if it's in the center of space. So you could say this is a little bit like a shift of perspective. Our usual perspective is that I am like this person in the center of space, and I'm identified with the center called the body, and the sense faculties seem like they're the center. But can I open to this strange possibility of shifting my identity so that my true identity, my true nature, is not actually this located body, but space, or in this case, boundless presence, is my nature. And that's, and then from this new perspective, I am space, spacious presence. From that perspective, this new type of self, you could say, this new identity of space, from that perspective, then is Tokyo's body in my center, me being space. You might say, no, as space, Tokyo is just one of the many centers. Everybody here in this discussion is a unique center. But I'm not so identified with this particular located body if I am space, right? Koko's body is one of them, you could say. But I can try on this kind of weird experiment of being more identified with unlocated space. But it still seems like there's a special relationship to Kokyo's body. It's different than, like, I can't see through all of your eyes. I, space, maybe am seeing through all of your eyes, but I'm only perceiving it through this one body's eyes. This might seem like strange questioning, and we could keep going with this, but it's just kind of getting started. You can take it from there if you like, at the very time of sitting. These are explorations having to do with body and mind that maybe would not dawn on us if we're just sitting in the present. These questions are too strange. They just naturally arise for us if we didn't intentionally ask them. Mitsu asks, can boundless presence have a perspective? If so, how? So I guess I did say that, right? But from the perspective of this body and mind, it feels like I am the center. From the perspective of boundless presence, there's many centers or no centers. So I think that's right. I think you point out a nice point that, strictly speaking, boundless presence doesn't have a perspective in the way we usually use the word perspective. Perspective or point of view, that's even more like, makes it even more obvious, right? Point of view is talking about this point in space that has a view that's a little different from the point of view of the person sitting next to me, for example. There are different points in space, and perspective is kind of like that too. So, great question. Maybe the word perspective is a little bit off for how it is if we are space. We don't exactly have a perspective, at least not in the usual way that humans have perspective. So that would be an example, I would say, of the right kind of question. I don't know what Coben meant by, you know, what he imagined was the right questions, but I think that's a good one because it's about our direct experience in body and mind. It's a little bit theoretical sounding, but I think we can ask it in a way that's actually relating to our direct experience right now. And it's a subtle question. There's another question in the chat. When we inhabit a point of view, is that ego identification? Yes, exactly. So that's a beautiful way to put inhabiting any point of view is, we could call it ego identification. So if we kind of make being spacious presence into subtly make it, even unconsciously make it into a kind of point of view, then that's made a very subtle kind of ego identification. So it's tricky business. This whole issue of Vipassana is a little tricky business because the questions are coming in concepts, and you could even say concepts are almost creating a point of view, or at least that's what they're usually doing, and therefore just conceptual thinking could be considered a kind of ego identification. So Vipassana hopefully doesn't fall into that type of conceptuality, but these are more questions we could ask, what the difference is. Questioning is very nice because it's an openness. A very active questioning is a kind of openness and non-fixation, just questioning itself. But then we're talking about, when Dogen talks about this issue of verification or confirmation, sounds almost like the opposite of just an open question. It's more like we need to verify for ourselves whether water is hot or cold. So there's some danger in this term, verification or confirmation. And yet, it looks like that's one way of talking about awakening from the time of the Buddha up to the present. It's a kind of experiential confirmation. So how does that not become reified in a conceptual way? I think of the example of tasting water and knowing that it's hot is, as a kind of example for confirmation, it's pretty good because that's not, there's not too much fixation there. If somebody starts really arguing with us and saying, no, it's not hot, it's cold. Say, no, it is hot. Like, I'm verifying it myself. No, it's not hot. Yes, it is. You know, we start hitting each other. And you could say, oh, we just were confirming a simple, verifying a simple direct experience. But it was fine until we started arguing about it. Now we're enemies. So something happened between the direct verification and grasping the conceptual version of it. And fighting about that one. And yet we can't ignore putting experience into words, which is the story came up the other day, right? Of like, how is it to try to talk about this? And I was saying, the Buddha at first, the legend is that the Buddha just after his awakening, he didn't want to talk about it. Maybe he also felt like, if I do, conceptualize it too much and people will start arguing with me, which they did actually in the sutras. Other yogis with different points of views did argue with the Buddha. And but he learned how to use words away without grasping them too tightly. And I think Zen is a tradition that's really good at using words and not grasping them too tightly. So Zen uses words so loosely that it seems to people like nonsense sometimes. It's so strange because it's not like this is like this because it's like this. It's more like just, you know, examine whether it's sitting that has dropped off, sitting within sitting. It's a little less graspable. We turn into Dogen's essay here. We left off where Dogen's quoting my late master, old Buddha, Rujin, said, practicing Zen is body and mind dropped off. Dropped off, dropping off, could be translated either way. It is attained, toku, only in shikan tada, single-minded sitting, without need for incense offering, bowing, chanting Buddha's name, repentance, or reading scriptures. And then Dogen goes on to comment on his favorite saying of his teachers. He says, in the past 400 or 500 years, it's my late master alone who plucked out the eyeball of Buddhas and ancestors and sat within its core. That's the way Zen ancestors talk. Why does he say 400 or 500 years? And the commentator speculated that that was the time of 400 years before Wu Jing and Dogen, was the time when Baijiang lived and first wrote this Zazen Gi treatise on how to practice Zazen. So that's one theory, is that that was an authentic Zazen instruction. But since that time, everybody got confused about Zazen up until my late teacher. Another way I think we could interpret is 400 or 500 years before Wu Jing, which was the time of Baijiang, was also the Tang Dynasty in China. It's considered the golden age of Zen. And all the koan stories that became classic Zen stories were all from this golden age time, at the kind of early centuries of Zen. These ancestors kind of defining this new style. And maybe Dogen, who mostly quotes those, you know, that Tang Dynasty golden age period Zen stories, he feels like they really like had it and could say it. And then it kind of degenerated over the centuries. And I think historically, Zen grew in popularity in China since that time, but the teachings, maybe some people could say that there was less of this really fresh creative style. It was more like commenting on the old teachers, like now, up until Rujin. But what a beautiful image. My late master alone scooped out Buddha's eye. Plucked out Buddha's eye and then sat within its core. Something about unbroken transmission. Shakyamuni Buddha, his eyeball, to maintain the authentic practice and verification the tourist needs to pluck out Buddha's eye and sit within its core. Somebody goes on, there have been few in China who could compare to him. Rare are those who have understood that sitting is the Buddha Dharma, and the Buddha Dharma is sitting. So this is an essay praising Zazen. Again, I think both the conventional physical posture of sitting, this is, we take this posture and we settle down, and in the silence and stillness of Zazen, and that this is Buddha Dharma. But also sitting seems in this essay to also mean the total realm of sitting, the boundless presence that is expressed most directly and purely and beautifully in the upright sitting posture of Zazen. So you might think, well, isn't most of Buddhist practice actually like sitting meditation? And maybe we kind of take that for granted as Zen people, thanks to people like Dogen, who's promoted this so much, and we make it our central practice. But not all schools of Buddhism make silent, upright sitting their central practice, interestingly. It's beautiful that we take that for granted. Really? What else could be more essential? Well, even in modern Japanese monasteries, this definitely are exceptions, but maybe mostly they are training and ceremony. In terms of number of hours, there's more hours of training in very elaborate ceremonies than there are silent sitting in Zazen. Even places like Eheji, look at their daily schedule, are kind of like that. So I think that's one beautiful thing about Zen coming to the West, is we really generally do emphasize Zazen. I think that's pretty universal. And even modern Japan, that's one of the things. Not to mention, this is the monasteries, but the smaller village temples of Soto Zen and Rinzai Zen, there might not be any Zazen going on. There's just like maybe one priest living there with his family, and he might do morning Zazen if he has time. And maybe once a month they have a Zazen Kai or something. We don't have time for just sitting. There's like ceremonies to do. Lots of funerals, especially. How wonderful the way Zen has been transmitted to the West so far is that there's strong emphasis on Zazen. Look at this, we can't even go to Jikoji for Sashin because of pandemic. So let's just do Sashin on Zoom. Where did Zazen? Nothing will stop us. Not even a global pandemic. So rare are those who have understood that sitting is Buddha Dharma and Buddha Dharma is sitting. The essence of Buddha Dharma is sitting. So it goes on. Some may have known experientially that sitting is Buddha Dharma, but none of them has known sitting as sitting. Some may have known that sitting is like the essential matter of Buddha Dharma, but none but my late teacher, old Buddha, Hu Jing, knew that sitting is sitting. this is a kind of koan we could take into Zazen, right, at the time of sitting. What does it mean that sitting is sitting? There's nothing extra added to sitting in order for it to be sitting. And there's nothing that needs to be subtracted from sitting in order for sitting to be sitting. Is the sitting in this posture, the sitting, the total realm of sitting of boundless presence, and is the total realm of boundless presence sitting? The sitting in this posture, are those two different truths? Or is this one sitting? How then could anyone, without knowing that sitting is sitting, how could anyone have been able to protect and maintain Buddha Dharma as Buddha Dharma? Some may have known that sitting is Buddha Dharma, but none of them have known sitting as sitting. How then could anyone be able to protect and uphold Buddha Dharma as Buddha Dharma? When Buddha Dharma is just Buddha Dharma, then sitting is sitting. When sitting is sitting, Buddha Dharma is Buddha Dharma. And you are you, and I am me. Hence, there is a mind sitting. There's a bunch of sittings in these next few sentences here. Where I ask, what does sitting is the Dharma mean? That's a question we could bring into sitting. But it seems to be emphasizing the Buddha Dharma's this entire, you know, tradition, this huge realm that includes so many different aspects, right? Buddha Dharma is hard to even talk about what it is. It's so vast, all these different schools, all the different philosophies, all the different practices. So it seems like Dogen is making a point here about like this whole complex, ungraspable realm called Buddha Dharma is just sitting, and sitting is essentially Buddha Dharma. It's kind of equating these things, which you could say is kind of a radical statement if we really think of how vast Buddha Dharma is and how much it could include. He's saying it's really just sitting. And again, we can ask, does he mean it's all it is like it, this one particular upright posture, or does he mean the total realm of sitting, which is boundless presence that includes everything within Buddha Dharma, but is being expressed through this posture? It's like almost like every sentence in the Shobo Genzo could be like taken up as a koan or as a vipassana inquiry. So hence there is a mind sitting. So here sitting is not just za, as it mostly is through the essay, but it's ta-za, as in shikan ta-za. And ta doesn't really mean anything. it's an emphasis. It, literally what it means is like strike or hit, ta. But it's in Shikan Taza, it's used as kind of like an emphasis. So when we translate it as just wholeheartedly sitting, I think it's a nice way to. Shikan is just, Ta is wholeheartedly. I often think of it as like, it's like an exclamation point. Just sit, like completely fully and vividly, strike sitting, but not literally strike, right? More like an exclamation point. But that's what's being seen in this case. Hence, there is a mind taza, a mind just, it's not just, a mind wholeheartedly sitting, I could say. Hence, there is a mind sitting. And it's not the same as a body sitting. Taza. There's a mind sitting, it's not the same as a body sitting. There's a body sitting, and it's not the same as a mind sitting. So we could say that this is, again, he's, I think, playing with this phrase, chopped off body and mind, right? So this is Dogen style, right? He's taking this body and mind, he's gonna like juggle these terms and, you know, in all these different ways. I thought they're like indistinguishable body and mind. And I think that's another point of view. I think it's valid. We can look at, well, what's the difference between body and mind? Like we're just exploring how body is just these tingly sensations arising in mind. And yet here he's emphasizing difference. We just want to become flexible with sameness and difference. So hence there's a mind sitting and it's not the same as a body sitting. At the time of mind or from the point of view of mind, there's nothing but mind. There's a body sitting and it's not the same as mind sitting. From the point of view of body, there's nothing but body. Whatever mind be added to this direct experience of body. There is sitting with body and mind dropped off, and it's not the same as sitting with body and mind dropped off. This is quintessential Dogen. Sitting in body, it's not the same as sitting with mind. You're sitting body and mind dropped off, and it's not the same as sitting with body and mind dropped off. So I don't think that Dogen's is randomly throwing things out for fun. Maybe sometimes he is, and I think he's probably is having fun doing this, but I'm imagining that. But I think that the genius of Dogen is that even these fun and twisted plays with all these different words, I think we really can take each sentence as having a particular Dharma point that it's making. And I think in this case, one way to hear it is there's sitting body with body and mind dropped off, and it's not the same as sitting with body and mind dropped off. We could put the second sitting with body and mind dropped off in quotation marks. Do you see how that would kind of like elucidate the meaning a little bit? In other words, sitting with body and mind dropped off is not the same as sitting with body and mind dropped off. Actual sitting with body and mind dropped off is not the same as our idea of sitting with body and mind dropped off. That was one way to hear the sentence. Just when we think we finally got it, it's just sitting with body and mind dropped off. Saying, no, that's just you're saying sitting with body and mind dropped off. And there's the actual sitting with body and mind dropped off. It's not those words. And there's maybe tens of thousands of other ways to interpret this sentence as well. Once you attain this state of suchness, emo, It's not a Buddhist technical term. It's a colloquial term that means thus or such. But sometimes it's used for the Buddhist technical term, suchness, ta-ta-ta in Sanskrit. Isn't this great? I think it's great that our tradition has as one of its technical Sanskrit philosophical terms, suchness, thusness. That alone, I think, makes it an awesome tradition. So there's other ways, you know, like nyoze is maybe more a standard translation of tata, but emo is a little more colloquial, and Dogen has a whole fascicle called Chogogenzo Emo, thus, and he brings up various Zen stories using this term emo. So you could say, once you attain suchness and attain harmonious unity of activity and understanding possessed by Buddha's ancestors, you examine exhaustively all the thoughts and views of this attainment. So this is another, like, a really great highlight sentence here. That gets lost in this translation, I think. So the first part is kind of clear. Once you attain suchness, or you could even say it, this as it is, what we've been talking about, body and mind dropped off. Realize thus, and are in accordance and harmonious unity with activity and understanding in accord, the activity and understanding of the Buddhas and ancestors. So there's that part, I think, is that's fine translation. Then the second part is more literally, it says, once you're in accord with the Buddhas and ancestors, then you should maintain this thought, idea, and contemplation. You should investigate this mind, thought, and consciousness. And why I say this is so wonderful is this is a reference, pretty clear reference, to the Fukan Zazengi, which uses the same set of six characters, and which are not that common. All six combined are not like a common thing in Zen teachings. So I think it's pretty it's pretty clearly a Dogen's kind of like reference to his own earlier teaching of Fukan Zazengi. And so if you recall yesterday, I mentioned Fukan Zazengi is Dogen's universal instructions for Zazen, is kind of like a shamatha oriented meditation instruction. It's saying, think of not thinking, turn the light around and shine it back, and body and mind of themselves will drop away. It's like, I think it's just about being the boundless presence before, and it doesn't talk about investigating the boundless presence. And so I think this pair of essays, the Fukan Zazengi and this King of Samadhi, form a nice pair, and they quote some of the same stories. But this earlier Fukan Zazengi is more about letting go of all thinking and just being presence. And it's much more renowned and known essay of Dogen. And this one comes later in Dogen's life, and he's saying, maybe he's like, you've all been studying and practicing the Fukan Zazengi for a decade now. It was written first in like about 10 years before this one. Now you can start investigating. And so this section that we're on right now is particularly pointing out this correlation. So the Fugan Zazengi, the earlier calm-abiding kind of orientation, says, for practicing Zen, a quiet room is suitable. Hope we are able to find that this week. Eat and drink moderately. Eat too much just before zazen, which we kind of have to because there's almost no breaks in the session. Then you get a little sleepy. I get sleepy after lunch. Cast aside all involvement, cease all affairs. Do not think good or bad. Do not judge true or false. And then here's the key sentence in this Fukan Zengi. These are Zazen instructions. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. And these are a little bit kind of Yogacara terms for citta, manas, and vijnana. It's the eighth, seventh, and sixth consciousness in the Yogacara system. It's not, we don't need to go into that, but saying in the system that's talking about all these different aspects of mind, these are the consciousnesses, the whole system of mind in Buddha Dharma, especially Yogacara. So give up all of it. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Any type of mental activity, give it up. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and contemplation. So these terms, thoughts, ideas, and contemplation, are also classic Buddhist terms. The thought here is like nin, like just thought, a thought moment. Ideas is the Chinese translation of the third skanda, samnya skanda, which is like conceptions, perceptions, or conceptions. I think maybe it works nicely here. Give up conceptions. And often we say views, but the Chinese character here, that one kan that I mentioned yesterday, is the standard translation for vipassana. So I think it's valid to translate this, which nobody seemed to do, but I think I would translate it like this, especially today. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and vipassana. Thoughts, ideas, and contemplation is another way of translating this contemplation, seeing, but the seeing that's a kind of contemplative investigation kind of seeing. It's the word for vipassana. So again, Fukan Zazengi says, give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring with thoughts, ideas, and contemplation. Have no designs on becoming a Buddha. So we follow this, these six characters. Give up the operations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring thoughts, ideas, and contemplation. It's good shamatha instruction. Now here in this zamai o zamai, this sentence is literally, once you attain suchness and harmonious accord with the actions and understandings of the Buddhas and ancestors, then you should maintain this thought, idea, and contemplation. You should thoroughly investigate this mind, intellect, and consciousness. So it's like the opposite instruction from the Fukan Zazengi. So I think, wow, this really, I think it really works to talk about these two as a pair, one being a kind of a shamatha treatise and one being a kind of vipassana treatise. Again, the shamatha version of the Fukan Zazengi. Give up the operations or circulations of mind, intellect, and consciousness. Stop measuring and evaluating your thoughts, ideas, and contemplation. Stop all six of these things. Give them up and stop them. And this one, once you're in accord with the understanding and activity of the Buddhas and ancestors, you should maintain this thought, idea, and vipassana contemplation. Maintain this contemplation. Don't give it up. And you should thoroughly investigate. It's the same term, sankyu, that Dogen used earlier and uses often. Means thoroughly examine this mind, thought, and consciousness. Don't give up this, the options of mind, thought, and consciousness. Thoroughly investigate mind, thought, and consciousness. Wow. When I looked at the Japanese here, I got very excited. Seems pretty clear that he's playing with this, contradicting his earlier teaching intentionally. It's not that either one is right or wrong. They're just two kind of modes of practice that go together very nicely. But there can be a time for emphasizing calm abiding and giving it all, letting go of thought. And then it can be a time for thoroughly investigating what is thought? How does thought come to be? Where is thought? I think most of these questions of who, what, when, and where are all generally good vipassana questions, but why is generally not so helpful, I think, a vipassana question. My teacher, old Buddha, Tension, when people ask him, why is there suffering? You know, well, why are we practicing like this? Why did the Buddha say it like that? He will always say, I don't answer why questions. But I'm happy to talk about who, what, when, where, how questions. Do you have any questions that don't involve why? Tom.
Well, I just wanted to ask, did I hear you correctly yesterday to be saying for the last 5 years, your Zazen has been these Vipassana investigations?
I think I did say something like that.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Is that all?
Well,
yeah. If we want to get, personal, I mostly, of course, always studying all these teachings through these years, but mostly in Zazen, it was more about letting go of thought and shamatha orientation. And a little bit like exploring the qualities of awareness that are how it's clear and present and how it's empty of possibility at the same time. That's still kind of in the realm of shamatha, but it's I guess if it's exploring these qualities, maybe already starting to explore. But I would say the last 5 years or so. Of course, I heard about Vipassana many years before that, but I always felt like it sounded to me, the way it was often presented, was a little too heady or something. Or like, I loved studying about it, but like in Zazen, I always felt like, well, it seems too conceptual for me, or I'm not quite sure how to access it without disturbing the Zazen. So somehow, looking into some of the Tibetan traditions, like Mahamudra especially, but Dzogchen somewhat, I wouldn't say the heart of them is this lots of conceptual questioning, but they have those practices of almost like preliminary to just resting in the boundlessness of awareness. We first have to clarify that it's boundless and some other points. So there's these traditions, because they're very kind of direct pointing traditions, have very experiential types of questionings. And then kind of felt like that type of questioning seems more acceptable. Make sure that it's not theoretical, but it's always about our direct experience, and it's trying to ask the right questions, or the questions that most are most conducive and directly shifting perspective.
Thank you, and thank you so much for these talks.
You're welcome. So there's another question. Can a bounded presence have perspective? Where does the bounded part end? I think in a way I would understand bounded presence is like there is a sense of being present, but it seems like limited consciousness maybe feels like a bounded presence. In a way, maybe that's one way of talking about bounded presence could be our usual consciousness that's kind of like moving through the world, and sometimes it's really distracted and thinking about past and future, but sometimes it's present, but it still seems like it's located in body and mind and head. And it's not like boundless space that that's not all inclusive. I think boundless and all inclusive are synonyms. Boundless means there's no edges. That means everything in parentheses means every experience in Buddha Dharma. We're always talking about our experience. There's nothing, we don't want to speculate about anything outside of our experience. So we could say boundless presence includes like looking at this, you know, tree half a mile away, like up on the ridge, and like that is included in this boundless presence. But maybe a bounded presence could be more like I'm present and aware, but that tree up on the ridge is half a mile away. That's not included in we might feel as if it's not included in this presence. That might be one way I would talk about a bounded presence, feeling located, and it's feel like not everything's included. And your presence is definitely different than my presence. I mean, we have some overlap if we're in the same room and we're talking, or the same screen and we're talking. We're interdependent, but we're not sharing one presence. We might feel this way, calling it a boundless presence or dualistic consciousness. And then the question is, cannot bound in presence have a perspective, I would say that is actually like a perspective. That is what a perspective is. And then we were referring to maybe having a perspective is the ego, is the sense of a separate self. And I think that's a bounded presence, maybe the sense of being an individual, a separate self. And then where does the bounded part end? I think if we, the edges of our self, and I would say if we start investigating that thoroughly, we will discover that it doesn't. And we will discover the boundlessness of presence. But usually we feel to be a kind of self-contained being. Was it Abraham Maslow, maybe, a psychologist, coined this term skin encapsulated ego back in the 60s? I think that call some term like that. You could say that's bounded presence. Skin encapsulated ego means like it's all every I am contained within this, the edges of the skin, and that's where I end. So it feels the bounded part ends at the skin. But if we start investigating more deep at the very time of sitting, we might find that that's not really where presence ends. In fact, I can't even with my eyes closed, I can't actually find where the skin ends and the sky begins. I'm thinking that it's like I have some sense of distance or something. But if I say, what if as soon as I close my eyes, the skin bag actually is like 300 miles wide, and when I open them, it suddenly shrinks again to a couple of feet wide. We might be able to like explore, like I can't really definitively define the edge of the skin when I'm not looking at it. Even when I'm feeling it with my eyes closed, it's a general location, but the edges become very blurry. And if I open my eyes and look at the edge of the skin, it seems sharp and clear. But maybe it's actually the edge is much blurrier than we think. So that's some thoughts. I'm not sure if that's what the question was aiming towards. But there's a response. And then Bungay says, I have a book called Mastering Jhana and Vipassana. What should I do? Wisdom wide and deep. Maybe best to not do anything at all. Nothing whatsoever. And she can continue non-doing, then you enter the first jhana. And with releasing any ideas about non-doing, you enter the second jhana. And so on. So this is a kind of Theravada Buddhist system, jhana and vipassana tradition. Was it like Catherine, that book? Yeah, amazing. There's some amazing contemporary jhana teachers in the Bay Area of California, I think. And interestingly, like some of the best are women, Shayla Catherine and Tina Rasmussen. They're like jhana experts, trained in Burma. And just a little bit from what I've read and heard from them, I think you can master these jhanas, and they can help one to do that. Jhanas, remember, are these concentration, absorption states, and they're very particularly defined, and there's levels through 4 and then 8. And at each level, one can like, there's little kind of trigger points that one can enter the next level. which is quite interesting, right? Because there's virtually no thinking going on. So these kind of trigger points or ways to shift levels are very, very subtle. But it's a tradition the Buddha practiced and taught to develop concentration. And then Vipassana is, in a way, jhana kind of fits into our shamatha category of concentration. And Vipassana is the investigation. So you can read this book and report back to us on, I think, particularly interesting for me and this discussion would be, how does she talk about the transition between jhana practice and Vipassana? To me, that's a very, very interesting topic to explore. How do we, if we're shifting from calm abiding, or even more radically, jhanas, non-conceptual, very non-conceptual realms, to somewhat conceptual investigations, maybe very slightly, but somewhat conceptual. How does this transition work? And how do we not lose the calm abiding upon investigating? And how do we not get lost in the calm abiding if we don't investigate? Or how could insight arise without? So the relationship between the calm abiding and the insight, I think, is a very interesting territory to explore. And there's a lot about it. And like this essay of Dogen. Laura. Colin-san.
I'm still kind of chewing on this paragraph of the Buddha Dharma. Rare are those who believe that sitting is the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha Dharma is the game. That sounds to me like Zazen is at the heart of all of it. So in a way, if you're in Zazen, all of the Dharma is available to you, and that's where all the Dharma came from. That's a guess. A kind of guess. And then some may have known experientially that sitting is the Buddha Dharma. That sounds to me like people have sat Zazen deeply and have experienced that wisdom for themselves. But none of them has known sitting as sitting.
Yeah.
What
would you say?
I mean, my intuition is that it's kind of transcending Zen in that moment. It's kind of saying, sitting, the posture and the boundless presence are even beyond Zen. Because then how, if you don't know what's beyond Zen, how could you be able to protect and uphold Zen, the Buddha Dharma as Buddha Dharma? But I don't know. That's kind of a guess. I didn't know how else to move with that.
Okay, like going beyond, something like this is implied. But yeah, it does seem that rare are those who understand that Buddha Dharma is sitting. There are a few who experientially know that's the case. But then there are none at all, like my late master. I think it's a little bit, Dogen's sort of tongue-in-cheek style, I think, of saying, almost nobody knows this. A few get this point. And then the points get more and more subtle. And then he's just to really praise his late teacher. It's only my late teacher, knows that sitting is sitting. So it's like, it's the most non-dual version of these, right? You could say sitting is Buddha Dharma is already making an amazing fresh point, but you could say it's still two different things. But when sitting is sitting, that's... what can even be said there? It's like nothing needs to be added to sitting for it to be sitting. Nothing needs to be subtracted from sitting for it to be sitting. It's like an inconceivable statement too. The previous things are somewhat conceivable. So sitting is sitting, and we could hear that as, again, this whole essay, I think this is play, and you can read every time the word sitting comes up, I think it could be read as the total realm of sitting, which I'm kind of hearing as this boundless presence, or the particular physical posture of sitting. And I think it's intentionally ambiguous, and that's part of the playfulness of using the sitting here in the way in this essay. So you could interpret those two sittings as these two different types. They only might, like, teacher knew that the physical sitting is boundless presence of the total realm. Only my lay teacher could confirm that the total realm of boundless presence is nothing but this particular posture. You could hear that too.
And what's the difference?
Maybe it's helping us to also, like, as these sentences go on, right? It's going from a little bit like two different realms, more and more refined, fewer and fewer people get this, until this is one person gets this, and the statement of what they get is this totally non-dual, ungraspable statement, which, after all this kind of conceptual elaboration of all these questions we should ask in Zazen, it's maybe a little bit, you could also hear it as, it's like circling back to the simplicity of shamatha. After we've said all of this and we're trying to get Dogen and all these things, you say, really the highest, most complete verification is just sitting is sitting. Like, very simple. These are all possibilities. As I say, you know, we're interpreting Dogen, we're all interpreting. He leaves it to us. So, Mitsu, do you have a follow-up?
Okay, there seems to be a little bit of an echo somewhere. I don't know if other people...
Oh, how's this? How about now? So Mitsu says, I wonder if Dogen is trying to help us merge conceptual thought with experience or presence. Yes, totally. Yeah, especially when he's saying you should investigate this mind, intellect, and consciousness and maintain this thought and so on, but especially thoroughly investigate the conceptual mind. So I think if we thoroughly, at the very time of sitting, if we thoroughly investigate the conceptual process, we can come to see that it's included within the boundless presence, right? If the presence is boundless, the conceptual thought must be arising within it, as it, inseparable from it, not even distorting the presence, but expressing the presence. This is a subtle point we can investigate. Usually it seems like, and it's sometimes taught, that conceptual thinking is the main thing that seems to obscure or hide the non-conceptual boundless presence. It seems to block it. The boundless presence never goes anywhere. It can't, it's not coming and going, right? It's always present. But we feels like we're totally out of touch with it, especially when we're really caught up in conceptual thinking. If you're like, we're really worked up, especially emotionally and conceptually, packaged all that together, and like, yeah, that person said that to me, and I said it to them, and then we're like, if somebody were to say, excuse me, is there boundless presence happening right now? We say, no, it's nowhere to be found. It's a million miles. And that is how it feels. We all know this. But we could say, really, it hasn't gone anywhere. It's just completely permeated. The presence is permeated through and through with heavy-duty conceptual and emotional thought. So, but if we're at the very time of sitting, we can kind of get in touch with the presence and its boundlessness more and more, then we can start investigating conceptual thought. Like in this Mahamudra tradition, one of the practices is first you're exploring the realm of calm abiding with like hardly anything happening, a little fish swimming through the silently through the shamatha, looking in the corners without disturbing it. And then once you've kind of gotten used to that, then they'll say, now give rise to a conceptual thought. Or even they say, give rise to like a strong emotion like anger, like try to create it. Imagine somebody insulting you or something, just during meditation. And only in order to then explore the relationship between the thought or the emotion and the space. And then they'll ask, like, now you have it going, you really feel worked up. Now see, like, is this feeling and this thought happening in the space as the kind of like expression of the space? Or is it something coming from outside, kind of like shooting arrows at the space and trying to smash the space? No, if the space is boundless, nothing's outside it. So then we want to get used to, can we, as Mitsu says, merge conceptual thought with experience or presence? In a way, you could say it's already merged. The space of presence is infused with conceptual thought right now and talking and thinking. It's the same presence. It's just like it's colored by the thinking, but the color doesn't really change the space. I think here's where the metaphor of the mirror works very nicely, right? The mirror, pure unchanging mirror, is like boundless presence. And then all these images are appearing on it, the images of conceptual thought and emotions and so on. But the images don't change the mirror at all. They're like, the images are like a coloring of the mirror. And the images are coming and going, but the mirror doesn't come and go. The coming and going images are inseparable from the mirror, and yet there's two different worlds. One is the images and one mirror. There's no space between them. They're truly non-dual, and yet the mirror doesn't come and go, and the images do come and go. So I think that's a really nice metaphor to explore at the very time of sitting, especially when there's a conceptual thought. And then Nenzen San says, is Dogen playing with the relative, our own experience of sitting, and absolute boundless presence sitting us? Yes, that in fact, that's this very point, right? The mirror is the ultimate unchanging boundless presence, and the which you could say is sitting us. We, us meaning like people, are like reflections on the boundless mirror, and therefore the mirror, you could say, is sitting the reflections. The mirror is supporting the reflections. The mirror is giving rise to the reflections, and we are the reflections. And then the relative would be our own subjective experience of sitting. I am just a reflection of Kokyo sitting in a certain posture on a postureless mirror. And I am completely inseparable. I, the body and mind of Kokyo, am inseparable from the mirror. And my true nature is the mirror. So the mirror metaphor works nicely with this issue of identification, right? identified with the reflection called this body and mind experience, temporary appearance on the mirror. We're so totally identified. We think that's who we really are, right? And I know it's a little problematic to say from the point of view of the mirror, right? But as the mirror, what is Tokyo's body and mind? It is the mirror, it's taking the temporary form of the appearance of each of our bodies and minds. And so you could say, and then the person, you could say maybe that the person Kokyo, at the very time of Zazen, sitting on the surface of the mirror, you could ask, well, you know, who am I really? What is my deepest nature? And look and see, and like, it's just the mirror. That's really like, almost like my true identity. It's a shift of identity. And I think that's one way of looking at this issue of studying the self and fixated on this particular body and mind identity as ourself. And of course, our tradition says, well, that's not self. We have the not self teaching is big style, you know, style of Buddha's teaching. We just don't identify with this body and mind as my true self. But this is like this boundless presence style is saying, well, is there nothing then? Boundless presence style says, no, there's boundless presence. That's who I actually really am. It's a little maybe dangerous. Some would say it's a little dangerous because then we don't want to identify in some fixed way that we're usually identifying with the mirror, like I'm the mirror. Even though may be some truth to the statement, I think the skillfulness of the not self teaching is just don't identify with anything. But of course, that doesn't mean that there's nothing left. What's left, what's always left, is indestructible, unchanging, boundless presence.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org. Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.